Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, on Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013. I'm your host, Joe Terry, and the South Bay Show is brought to you by Tapas and Vino. Located in the heart of Riviera Village, Tapas and Vino offers an idyllic location to meet and eat and has quickly become a favorite destination of local foodies. Opened in October 2011, this charming bistro offers an eclectic menu of small plates, salads, soups, and entrees for lunch and dinner daily. In addition, brunch is served every Saturday and Sunday with endless, yes, that's right, endless mimosas and bellinis. The popular outdoor patio boosts a vibrant scene each evening and features live music every Tuesday night. The extensive wine list offers varietals from regions around the globe, and brew enthusiasts will appreciate the comprehensive beer selection. Tapas and Vino also hosts monthly wine and or beer education events, provides off-premise catering, and has a private dining room for small groups. Tapas and Vino is currently running a Not Just Tapas and Vino campaign. For listeners of the South Bay Show, mention the South Bay Show or South Bay by Jackie, and receive 25% off a lunch or Saturday and Sunday brunch entree. Be sure to visit the Tapas and Vino Facebook page for weekly specials and discounts. Tapas and Vino is located at 1729 South Catalina Avenue in Redondo Beach. For more information, visit the website at tapasevino.com or call 310-791-8200. You can find out more about us at facebook.com/The South Bay Show or visit our website at thesouthbayshow.com. Preparing for disaster in America. This is a subject that can never be treated lightly, but we do our best to make it interesting, engaging, and yes, even entertaining to learn the few key skills and primary information that could save your life, your family's lives, that of a neighbor in a time of crisis, or the life of a treasured pet. Our mission is to engage hearts and minds and build knowledge and skills to help you prepare for whatever may come. This show is a true collaboration with Solid Roots in the Community and a partnership with the Official Disaster Preparation Establishment. Our producer is the president of the local Manhattan Beach Community Emergency Response Team Association, Mr. George Butts. Hey, George, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, all. It's supposed to warm up today. Who knows? Might be a nice day.
It might. It's going to warm up. It's we're in a warming trend. That's what they say. And, of course, with us today is owner-producer-writer of SouthBayByJackie.com, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Joe. How are you? Hi, George.
Good morning.
So we are going to be discussing something very exciting and interesting with a great guest, and I see that guest is ready and willing to join us. I'm going to just add them to our conversation right now. So
while you do that, I will go ahead and do the intro.
Yes.
All right. Our guest this morning is Rick Wilson. Rick is a senior engineering geologist with the California Geological Survey who has worked for over 20 years in the geologic and seismic hazard fields, much of it with the state seismic hazard mapping program. For the past 6 years, Rick has been the science coordinator for the state of California's Tsunami Preparedness and Hazard Mitigation Program, a program headed by the California Emergency Management Agency. This program with tsunami researchers for the University of Southern California recently completed work on statewide tsunami inundation maps for emergency planning and is working on similar tsunami hazard products and guidance for the maritime and land use planning communities. Rick is also the state science representative of the Coordinating Committee of the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, a partnership between federal and state government agencies designed to reduce the impact of tsunamis through hazard assessment, warning guidance, and mitigation. He also serves as the state co-chair of the NTHMP Mapping and Modeling Subcommittees, which helps guide state and federal tsunami hazard mapping efforts to help make sure they are done in an accurate and consistent manner. Now, for more information about the California Geological Survey Tsunami Program, you can visit that website at www.tsunami.ca.gov. So this morning, guys, it's all tsunami all the time. Welcome to the show, Rick. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, so Rick, I just have to ask you, are you on speakerphone or do you have a headset?
I'm actually I'm on the Skype, and I don't know if you can see me now, but
well, we don't do video. It's
oh,
radio.
You don't do.
Yeah. But do you have a headset?
I do not. No.
Okay, good. Well, then we'll go with what we're going with. Eh? It's all about tsunamis and geology, and so we'll just imagine you in the field. Where we can hear the rustic waters rushing behind you and so forth.
I apologize about that.
That's fine, Rick. That's fine. We're very glad to have you on the show, and I understand that you did a presentation that George was present at. What was that presentation?
It was kind of to commemorate Tsunami Preparedness Week. And the city of Manhattan Beach had been interested in, increasing their tsunami preparedness. And so I came in, they invited me to come and talk about some of my experiences with tsunamis. I've been part of the tsunami program for a half decade, and it's been a very good experience to be able to help communities prepare better for tsunamis.
Right. Now, you know, we, of course, being that we are, Disaster in America, we talk a lot about different regions of the country and the sort of the major disasters that they are subject to. California, we talk a lot about earthquakes, but tsunamis, this is a new one on all of us. I mean, of course, we were all awoken to the terrible, devastating potential just 2 years ago. It seems a lot longer than that, but it really was just 2 years ago.
It was longer than that. The tsunami in Indonesia was older than that.
Yeah, that's true.
Two years ago was Japan.
Right.
But that terrible one in Indonesia, that was my wake-up call.
Do you remember when that was, Rick, the Indonesian tsunami?
It was December 26th in 2004.
2004, wow, okay. Oh. So can you just give us right off the top for everyone, the listeners and myself, really a quick primer on exactly what a tsunami is and why we are potentially subject to that kind of a disaster here in California?
Yeah, tsunami is it gets mistaken a lot for a breaking wave that you see people try to surf. A tsunami is not a surfable wave, and actually we don't really like to call it a wave. It's really a surge. It's almost as if the world is tilted onshore and the ocean just rushes directly onshore. That's what a large tsunami will look like. That's what we see with a lot of the videos from Japan and Indonesia, the water just rushing, onto shore from the ocean. And it's not really just one surge or one wave. It's a series of waves. It can come on shore traveling at about 20 to 40 miles per hour. It can do a lot of damage, obviously. It's not something that we're normally set up for along the coastal areas. We're so typically concerned about our river flooding from uphill areas. We don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the ocean actually rushing on shore. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those types of very low probability, very high risk, or high potential damage events, where it's just flooding, that can go anywhere, and it really can happen at any time. They're typically created by very large earthquakes offshore.
So this is something that we enjoy a wonderful relationship with the ocean here in Southern California, and of course all along the coast in Oregon and Washington State. But here in Southern California, I think the relationship is a little more intimate. I mean, you have people well, here, right here in Manhattan Beach and Hermosa and Redondo, with homes, you know, just a few hundred yards from the water, a tsunami could be terribly devastating if it were to hit here in Southern California. What do you see, since you've been preparing for this for some time, what are some of the scenarios that you think that we might see and that you're preparing for?
Yeah, California doesn't have a very long history of tsunamis. We don't have it recorded, so we do have to kind of come up with scenarios that you know, are in our imagination of what kind of worst case scenarios could happen that haven't happened in our historic time. So some of the things that we look at are these very distant events, very similar to the magnitude 9 in Japan. We basically take a magnitude 9 earthquake and move it around the Pacific, the rim of the Pacific Ocean, where we have the Ring of Fire, basically, where we have a lot of these very large tsunamigenic type faults around the Pacific. And then we also look at the landslides offshore, the potential for a submarine landslide to be generated by a lot of shaking, you know, to see what would happen if a landslide were to be triggered, and then that would trigger a tsunami. But for Southern California, the good news is we don't have one of these really large subduction zones right offshore. We don't have a very, we don't have a fault that creates tsunamis, you know, that creates these really big tsunamis. In general, we have faults that are they're parallel to the San Andreas Fault, and they only have lateral motion. They don't have the vertical motion that you need to create a tsunami. So that's the good news for Southern California. You know, in our modeling that we've done for the California Emergency Management Agency and in production of maps that, that are on our website for California, we've only seen kind of a maximum wave height or tsunami height of about 10 to 15 feet in Southern California. So that's really good news, because you're right, we do have very, you know, very prone or vulnerable areas along the coast, because we have a very high population in Southern California.
Right.
But generally we don't see that we're going to get a really huge tsunami like they did in Japan or Indonesia. It's going to be on the order of about, you know, 10 to 15 feet, which still can do a lot of damage, but it's not going to be, we still need to plan for it too, but it's not something that we have to be, you know, worried like Japan was worried.
Now, there was a fallout of disaster or damage that occurred in 2011. The tsunami in Japan actually did reach California. Lots of people were at the beaches, sort of being looky-loos and waiting for it to come, like it was going to be an event that
yeah.
they could actually enjoy.
Right.
It turned out to be not a non-event here in Southern California. I know several people that went to the beach to try to see what it was going to look like. But there was some actual damage that occurred, not here, but in Oregon. Isn't that right, in Newport?
Well, you might be surprised, Joe, that we actually did have damage in Southern California to a number of harbors and bays.
Right.
Even all the way down to San Diego. Shelter Island actually lost several boats to this tsunami. And it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't, you really couldn't see it if you were on the beach, but if you went inside the harbors, you'd see some really strong currents going in and out for 24 hours. And so we had damage to boats and docks in San Diego Bay. We had them in Long Beach area and Redondo Beach harbors, King Harbor there in Redondo Beach. We had damage up in Ventura Harbor even. So about 27 different harbors in California had damage on the order of about $100 million
right.
from that tsunami. And but you're right. It wasn't as devastating, obviously, as Japan. And if you were on a beach, yeah, you wouldn't have seen it other than seeing that the tide goes out a little bit further and then the water comes up on the beach a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't like seeing people in harm's way like that. You know, going down to the beach to watch, because, you know, as great as we are predicting what kind of, forecasting what kind of wave heights you might get in a certain area. They really need to kind of stay away from the beach and from the waterfront areas.
Right, right. I thought at the time, I don't think I want to go down to the beach to see this. It might not be a great idea. But
yeah, right.
Okay, now we know a little bit about what a tsunami is. We know a little bit about, our sort of real risk sort of profile here in Southern California. But what do you think, obviously you studied this a lot. You're responsible for managing sort of the tsunami information website here at california.gov. Tell us a little bit about the Department of Conservation. What is it that what is your main focus there?
Yeah, I'm part of the California Geological Survey. So we're within the Department of Conservation. At CGS, we do a lot of work with all different types of hazards, everything from earthquake hazards to flood hazards, mm-hmm. Really from a geologic perspective. A lot of our mandates to do work are related to laws that have passed, like the Seismic Hazard Mapping Act, which we have a group that goes out and maps potential landslide areas and liquefaction areas that would be related to very strong shaking in California. I'm the tsunami program lead at CGS, and we are also interested in making sure that we can provide the best tools for local communities for emergency response activities, evacuation planning, maritime planning, which we obviously have been impacted by the last two tsunamis actually that have caused damage in California. And then land use planning. We look at Japan and we see, the land use issues that they've had to deal with not only before the tsunami but after the tsunami, trying to rebuild in Japan. So we're really interested in kind of the full spectrum of making sure that the public and those communities along the coast have the best information available.
Do we have an issue with tsunamis in any other state in the union, or is California unique in that way since we're here on the Ring of Fire?
As good of a situation, or relatively speaking, Southern California is in, our north coast in California is in the opposite situation. We actually have a subduction zone, Cascadia subduction zone, which is offshore, that has the capability of creating a magnitude 9 earthquake and causing a very large tsunami locally up in Crescent City and Humboldt Bay area. And we've been very active in that area because we're really concerned about the higher risk areas.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen is some of these other areas in Central California could get hit also from a distant event. In some cases, we've seen tsunami surges and from our modeling going up to 20 to 30 feet. So we are concerned in those areas also. But our north coast is really our primary focus of a lot of work. And this subduction zone goes all the way from Cape Mendocino all the way north to British Columbia. So that whole stretch of coastline from British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and Northern California is one of our most potentially worst-case scenarios in the U.S. But we also have a similar type of subduction zone off the shore of Alaska, which was that particular one was responsible for the 1964 earthquake, which will be the 50th anniversary next year of that event. So we do have tsunami threats in the U.S. We just need to make sure that we, the states are and the federal government really do the best we can to help out the local communities prepare for them.
Well, what I was really getting at was that we have here in Southern California, you could probably help me understand this a little bit better, but our beaches are beautiful, but not very wide. For instance, I have relatives that live in South Carolina. Some of the beaches in South Carolina seem to be like you could walk out into the ocean like a half a mile and still it's only like, you know, 3 or 4 feet deep because the beach is so long or so wide. Are there other areas in the country that also have tsunami potential for damage, or is California really the hot zone for tsunamis in the United States?
There's two areas that are really kind of the, you know, hot zone, if you want to call it that, that have the potential for large tsunamis, and that would be anywhere around the Pacific Ocean, because of the Ring of Fire, because of those very large potential events that can occur. And then in the Caribbean, there are also subduction zones off the coast of Puerto Rico that can influence Puerto Rico. But for the most part, our East Coast and our Gulf Coast, the tsunami threat is relatively low because we don't have those very large subduction zones that can create these big tsunamis. That still doesn't, you know, again, it, like you pointed out, it's so flat-lying on the East Coast. The ocean is very shallow. A very small wave can inundate can go pretty far inland, as we've seen with, you know, some of the hurricane damage. So it's still a potential danger that they could have a large landslide offshore that could trigger a tsunami. But for the most part, we're really concerned about the West Coast, Alaska, and Hawaii. Hawaii also is one of those locations, although they don't have very large faults offshore to create tsunamis locally, they seem to get hit pretty hard by every tsunami around the Pacific. As a matter of fact, back in 1946, there was a really good-sized tsunami that was generated in the Aleutian Islands, and it hit the Hilo Bay, and it killed several hundred people. So it's you know, Hawaii is one of those areas that is also vulnerable. So for most part, it's around the Pacific that we're most concerned about.
There has been a lot of activity, in the last 10 years around the Ring of Fire, and it does seem to be moving. If you look at a map of the Pacific and you know, from Japan and like 2004, the tsunamis in Indonesia, events seem to be moving, marching around the Ring of Fire. Do you see that as a professional, that there's been more activity in the last 10 years than the previous 10?
Yes, that there has been more activity, and it kind of did start with the Indonesian earthquake in 2004. Although it's not part of the Ring of Fire because it's pointed more towards the Indian Ocean, we have seen more activity in the last 10 years or so, starting with that event. And then we had a relatively large tsunami that was generated by the 2010 Chile earthquake, magnitude 8.8. And then again, we had the Japan earthquake, which is magnitude 9. It's really difficult to say if they're related. I'll say this though: the more we know about science, the more sometimes we're surprised that we haven't had these large events at this time. But when you look back at 1960s, we had two large events then too. In 1960, we had a large magnitude 9.5 earthquake in Chile that caused a very large tsunami, and then the 1964 tsunami in Alaska. So there may be, you know, somewhat of a pattern here where we do get some triggering from one area to another, but it's very difficult to say if there's like a direct correlation. We haven't gotten the science down yet to really say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is fascinating, Rick. It really is, because this is not something that we normally talk about and that people, I think, are aware of. In general, we're talking with Rick Wilson. He's with the California Geological Survey, part of the Department of Conservation. And you say you're the lead for tsunami information. Is that right, Rick?
Yeah, I'm the lead scientist at California Geological Survey for tsunamis. Although we don't have a very large program, there are support from other scientists that help with a lot of the outreach activities and some setting up. We have policy group. We have a policy group at CGS that brings in experts from all different walks of life that kind of helps lead what we should do in the future. And so we also have people that are involved with that. But yeah, it's a program that's supported by the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, which is we have membership in, and the California Emergency Management Agency also has membership in.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I have a question.
Yes.
When was National Tsunami Awareness Week established?
Boy, that's a good question. I wish I had. I knew exactly when it was established. What we've tried to do is have it be the third or fourth week in March. And since I've been involved, we've really stepped up how much outreach we really try to put into getting the word out to people. If I had to say, it would probably really ramped up after 2004. Since that particular tsunami, it was so devastating and unimaginable almost. I think we've really done a lot to make sure that we take at least 1 week to really, you know, prepare for this particular type of hazard. I wish I could tell you more. I don't know the exact date when it started, though.
Right.
Yeah, because prior to 2004, you know, tsunami was just a word in the spelling bee.
Right.
You know, I didn't really. It's not something I worried about.
What's that movie that's out now? There's a movie that's out that that depicts events during that tsunami in Indonesia.
It was about a family, right?
Yeah.
They got separated. I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah, it was called The Impossible.
That's right.
Yeah, it was a pretty impressive display of what the tsunami actually looks like, and equally devastating. It's very difficult to watch because it's so realistic. Not only the actual surges coming in, but the after effect. It's not one of those things I actually did take my family to go see it.
Uh-huh.
I have teenage children, and I figured, well, they've seen a lot of other things on TV, so they could probably handle that. And I can remember walking out of there, and it's the first movie I think we've ever done where we've come out of, and we actually did a family group hug because it was so, you know, it left such an impression on my kids and my wife.
Wow.
But, yeah, we actually worked with the California Emergency Management Agency to put together a movie review, if you will, for that. We call it a geological, you know, how logical is the geology part of it, movie review. And it's just, you know, one of those kind of situations where, you know, Hollywood is very well demonstrated what the devastation and what a tsunami looks like. And we wanted to make sure that the public, you know, if they did see it, understood, you know, that Hollywood got it right this time when it comes to how a tsunami looks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
George here. Haven't had a word in yet.
Yeah.
not since you came on, but which is okay. All right, because I like to listen. But just quickly, the other night you had mentioned, and I thought our listeners would probably want to know also that they are still finding cameras, digital cameras from the Japanese tsunami with pictures that they're able to recover, as I understood it. And I think that just goes back to you made the statement earlier about tsunamis coming. Well, let's go down and take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And who knows how many of these people and these cameras that actually belong to somebody that may not be there anymore because they wanted to go down and take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And they put themselves in harm's way.
Yeah,
that was it. That's all I wanted to say.
No, I think you're right, and it was they are coming out with new video clips all the time, and I think it is because they're finding these cameras and taking the video out of them, and Unfortunately, you're right. There were a lot of people that, that videotaped these events and put themselves in harm's way to do it, unfortunately. In California, you know, as we were talking about, we don't like seeing people go down to the waterfront. That's the first thing that we do not want to happen. But we do appreciate all the video they took. And so we've made a database of all the videos that have been taken in California, especially inside the harbors. And we use that video to kind of give a time history of the tsunami in the harbor so that we can see how and where the damage occurred and where the strong currents were occurring, so that we can kind of calibrate or validate the modeling that we're doing for the strong currents. So despite the fact that it's a very negative thing for people to go and you know, get close to the water and observe it, they really should be thinking about going the other direction. We do appreciate the videos that they were collecting.
Very just riveting, the video of the small harbor up north as the wave came in, and literally the docks and everything were lifted about 2 feet or so. It shows you this, just that one wave that then started throwing everything around was enough to make me want to back up a little bit more.
Right. We're going to take a station break, and we're talking with Rick Wilson from the California Geological Survey, Department of Conservation. We're talking tsunamis today, and we're learning a lot about tsunamis and what our risks are. And we're going to ask Rick Wilson for some more information about that. But right now, we'd like to thank a sponsor. We're going to thank a sponsor. Who are we going to thank today, Jackie?
Well, let me give you a hint. It's April.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So, you know, it's never too early to begin planning your financial future. When it comes to protecting your assets and hard-earned dollars, you'll want experienced professionals with a proven track record and flawless reputation on your team. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong, certified public accountants and consultants, is the largest full-serving accounting firm in the South Bay, and they're dedicated to providing professional services of the highest quality. The partners are South Bay residents, deeply committed to serving the communities where they live, work, and play. They support a variety of local nonprofit organizations such as Skate Park PB, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy, the Torrance South Bay YMCA, Palos Verdes Rotary, and Pediatric Therapy Network, among others. BCWS prides itself on providing national accounting technical experience with the personal attention of a local company. This commitment to uphold high standards of excellence has proven key to their success and first-rate reputation. Their ultimate goal and reward is to see their clients achieve financial success as they define it, whether that means helping them to reduce their tax burden, assisting them with planning to ensure their financial security, succession planning, exit strategies, and wealth transfer. The partners and professionals of BCWS are committed to providing their clients with the expertise and guidance they need to reach their financial goals. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong is dedicated to helping you navigate to financial success. Call 310-542-0011 for a free consultation, or you can visit the website at www.bcws.com.
BCWS.com.
And how many days do we have left before tax day?
Oh, no.
Yes.
Just 2 weeks now. Just
yep.
2 weeks. Here we go.
Okay.
And I really especially like that concept of wealth transfer. I just need to find out a rich guy to get transferred from. I don't
exactly.
know. Exactly. Wealth transfer. Or hey, even a rich lady. That would be fine too.
Whatever works.
So Rick, we are, you know, in a beautiful place. On the planet, Southern California, we really truly enjoy special weather, special the arts and everything we have here in the greater Los Angeles, San Diego areas. Southern California is just a wonderful place to live, but we do have these potentials for disaster, whether they be floods or mudslides. We have the fires, of course. Of course, there's the big one, the earthquakes. Where does tsunamis rate in terms of the hazards that Southern Californians regularly deal with?
That's a really good question. In my mind, it's very important because I work with it on a daily basis, and so I have to kind of look beyond myself sometimes to realize that sometimes that emergency managers and the public, do have a lot of other issues to deal with. I would say that it's from a perspective of where it fits in. It'd probably be one of the lower hazards. But there is a misconception out there that, they don't happen very often. The thing is that, as you pointed out, we seem to be kind of in a pattern here where we've had several in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And although the damage to Southern California isn't expected to be tremendously great unless we get one of these very large events that, like from the Aleutian Islands, seems to be, kind of tied to Southern California, or from Chile, if it's a very large event, or an offshore landslide, that could be generated. Those would be the types of events that would really do a lot of damage of inundation in Southern California. The thing is that we don't, every harbor in the state is susceptible to every tsunami, if you will. So that's where we're really concerned about tsunamis, because 9 times out of 10, we're going to get a tsunami that just impacts our harbors, not inundating dry land. So although it's a very, like I said, it's a very low probability event, it has the potential of doing a lot of damage because people aren't prepared enough for them. Because it's not one of those things we think about daily, that people don't tend to think much about tsunamis. So that part, I think the low understanding or the inexperience with tsunamis is actually works against us sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Rick, I hate to say this, but even with those disasters that you hear about constantly, such as earthquakes, people still aren't prepared for those.
Oh, you're right.
The vast majority of people are still not prepared for an earthquake, and they're bombarded with information about those.
Exactly. I think you're right there. So you're right. A lot of people, unless they're directly impacted by something, they usually don't take action. Or if they are, emotionally, charged by some type of disaster, then sometimes they'll take action. But, we just really want to get the word out to the public that, if you do, we truly do try to tie it to earthquakes because there is a relationship there, and if you're on a beach or you're down by the water and you feel a very large earthquake, that will basically be your warning sign that, that there may be a tsunami. So we just ask people that they make sure that they get off the beach or away from the waterfront if they feel a really large earthquake along the coast. That doesn't mean a tsunami is going to be generated, but it's certainly worth saving your life by just taking a few minutes to get off the beach and make sure that that tsunami is not coming onshore.
Right. I get the general sense that we are very well informed through your efforts, the California Geological Survey, Department of Conservation. We're very well informed about what the potential damage could be. Can you talk a little bit about the tsunami warning system that's in place in the Pacific? We often hear about that, but I've never had a good, succinct explanation of how that works and where it's located. There are buoys throughout the Pacific that are measuring the height of the ocean. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a very robust system that the national government through NOAA, the National Weather Service, that runs this program. We basically have two warning centers that are tied to the U.S. Mm-hmm. One is in Hawaii, and they're responsible for the Pacific Ocean outside of the West Coast and Alaska. And we get all our warnings and messages, our alerts, from the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, and that's in Palmer, Alaska. So we really like to try to steer away from the Pacific Warning Center in Hawaii. We like to focus more on the Alaska Warning Center and the West Coast Alaska Warning Center. So what happens when you have a tsunami, a very large earthquake, we have seismometers out there that are recording the size of the earthquake. And once it starts to get above a magnitude 7.5, and we start to think that maybe this could be a magnitude 8 to 9 range earthquake, a lot of the instant messaging goes out to the public from the Warning Center telling people that we've had a large earthquake. We think that we don't know if there's a tsunami yet. Just stay tuned. And then over the next hour, as they nail down the size of the earthquake and they start to see a wave generated and hitting not only what are called the deep ocean buoys, which are called dark buoys, and also the tide gauges along the coast to see if a tsunami wave has actually been generated. And if it has been generated, then they plug that information into their supercomputer that they have there at West Coast Alaska Tsunami Warning Center to generate what the forecast would be along, say, our coastline. If the tsunami was generated in Japan, there's about a 10-hour time period between when it was generated and when it arrived. So within that first hour, they are actually trying to forecast, based on this information from the earthquake, the tide gauges, and the buoys, what the wave heights will be along our coastline and when the tsunami will arrive. They put those messages out into the public's eye, and so that they can know that a tsunami was generated. And then within that period of time, they're also trying to decide what level of alert to put out. And there are several different levels that they go with. The two that are most important are an advisory level, which is anywhere where you have a expected tsunami height between 1 foot and 3 feet. And that usually indicates that you're going to get very strong currents inside harbors, but you're not going to get inundation of land. And then the other type of alert is called a warning level of alert. And that warning level is actually anything above 3 feet. And in that case, we may get inundation of dry land. During the Japan tsunami for areas north of Point Conception, we were put into a warning level because we saw that the tsunami was going to be greater than 3 feet. We were fortunate that we were at low tide conditions when the tsunami arrived, and for the main part of the tsunami, because of the low tide conditions, we didn't see a lot of inundation from it. We still did get those very strong currents, though. But that's basically how the whole system works. And the warning centers update that information on an hourly basis to let coastlines around the Pacific know what to expect.
Right, right. Well, Rick, it's good to know that we have such good information here in California, and we have people that are ready and studying this and watching to help us prepare for what could be a surprisingly devastating disaster, because people are not thinking about tsunamis every day. But we really appreciate your efforts and all the efforts from the Department of Conservation. We're going to come back to you, Rick, in a moment. We're going to give George an opportunity to tell us what's happening. And/or George, do you have any questions for Rick?
I do not right now. Maybe when we come back, just tell us about maybe the three or four the three or four ways that a tsunami is created. I remember some of them. It could be a volcano, a landslide. All right, throw that out to our that was interesting. But coming up tomorrow evening, our own Jackie continues her women's self-defense class at the Triton Room at Fitness Evolution at 200 North Harbor Drive in Redondo Beach at 7 p.m. It is women's self-defense, designed for women by women. And the rumor has it that it continues to be fun and informative. Coming up this Thursday, the Tri-City CERT organization of Gardena, Hawthorne, and Lawndale is having their monthly meeting, and a speaker will be in to talk about hydration for the emergency responders. It is a major from the U.S. Air Force Auxiliary that's going to come in and speak of that. That will be at the Gardena Baptist Church this coming Thursday from 6:30 until 9, the speaker and then their meeting, 1630 West 158th Street in Gardena, upstairs. So if anybody's interested in hydration and making sure you are able to continue to, we can all do without food. We cannot do without water. So we do need to do that. Coming up then on April 20th and 21st is the SAGE Expo in Manhattan Beach, Sustainable and Green Environments. It's going to be a weekend of 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. of lots of exhibits. We as an organization, CERT, will be there along with our partners in crime, so to speak. The Red Cross will be there exhibiting, as well as More Prepared. And we are going to do some workshops on first aid and hands-only CPR. A couple of us will get up and have a chance to speak on Sunday afternoon about some disaster preparedness on the stage and in front of everyone. So that's going to be at the Army National Guard Armory on Bell Avenue in Manhattan Beach, and that is on 420 and 21 from 10 to 4 each of those 2 days. On 427, we will have our next CPR AED class available, and anybody interested in that, we have 3 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. We're trying to get at least 10 in each class, or we might try to combine the two just for simplicity's sake. 511, May 11, the Manhattan Beach Police and Fire Open House will be taking place in the back portion of our police and fire in the back lot. That's always good. The kids get to see Sparky, the little fire truck that runs around and talks to them. And there'll be demonstrations, and also we will be there to assist and inform. That's what's going on in the neighborhoods. Upcoming shows this next Tuesday, we're going international. We're going to talk about how to communicate to the masses without the internet, right, from London, England. And Lawrence Meyerson of SMS Business Continuity and Disaster Management will be our speaker. We just lost our 416 guest, but on 423, we are going to talk about why there are these active killers on the rise, and in terrorism, is it going to happen here, and if so, what? And that'll be James Babylon from All Risk Consulting. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go back to that thing we really don't want to talk about, but we're going to talk about terrorism some more. And I would like to congratulate the two of you and myself, and that today is our 52nd show.
There you go.
And we are 1 year old.
Yeah.
And we're still talking to each other.
Yeah. Just little families.
Only on air. Only on air.
And that's it. That's it this week. And if we have a chance to wrap up, just real quick, Rick, the four ways a tsunami can happen.
Congratulations on your 1 year anniversary, by the way.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
A tsunami is generally anything that displaces the water, the ocean water. So 90-95% of all tsunamis are caused by fault displacement below the sea surface. So anything that's a vertical displacement of the ocean bottom usually propagates up to the surface as a tsunami. So that's about 90% or more of the tsunamis are generated that way. The other way, as I mentioned, also was the landslides, and about 5 to 8% of the tsunamis that are generated are caused by either underwater landslides or landslides that fall into the water that create a wave at the surface. And then you also have the potential for a volcanic eruption or an asteroid hitting the water and causing a displacement, but those are very low probability events. The volcanic hazard is definitely one that they're concerned about on the East Coast, but those are the four main ways that tsunamis can be generated, but really focusing on the earthquakes and the potential for a landslide are the ones we have to worry about here in California.
Okay.
And yet Hollywood makes all those movies about asteroids.
Yeah, it's certainly a way to get our attention, and it gives this the special effects people a chance to really expand their horizons. And
yeah.
It is also one of those things that we need to kind of use against, what we're trying to get the messaging out. And, a show like this is just, it's terrific to be able to talk about that although Southern California still has a tsunami hazard, it's not that bad compared to earthquakes and some of these other hazards that you have to deal with maybe on a daily basis or, a yearly basis. It's something that we can prevent ourselves getting injured if we stay away from the water when we know that there's a big earthquake offshore or anywhere in the Southern California area, just to be careful along the waterfront.
Right. But Rick, of course, I can't let you go. You have some experience with the California Geological Survey. You've been out in the field. You've explored California to some degree. Have you ever run across any gold?
In my younger days, as a geologist, I definitely was interested in gold, and I did a little gold panning when I was younger, coming out of college, and I found some, in some areas. But it is something, it is our state mineral. And we have a lot of information about gold at the CGS website if you want to learn more about it.
Right. I saw that there's at the CGS website, which I have as www.conservation.ca.gov/CGS. And then there's many other things there as well. But they have a little quick hits. And you can click on gold, and they actually have a PDF that talks about some of the better places to pan for gold in California. Of course, the price is about $1,580 an ounce, so it's pretty profitable if you found a few ounces.
That's true. Yes, and we have a lot of those. A lot of those, we call them CGS notes, information about. Either geologic hazards or geology, rocks and minerals, faults. If you want to learn anything about geology in California, you can go and look at those notes and learn a lot more.
Right.
Hey, Rick, I have a question for you. At the town hall meeting in Manhattan Beach last week or 10 days ago, whenever it was, what kind of questions did the audience have?
Well, it was a very good audience. We had about 80 to 100 people there. They were asking questions about... what they should do during a tsunami. I think they were most interested in understanding, if there is a tsunami, how far inland is it going to go in Manhattan Beach, which because Manhattan Beach kind of goes up a slope pretty good, quickly from the ocean, there isn't going to be a whole lot of inundation in that area. But that was their main two questions were about, what the hazard was directly there, and then what they can do. And as I mentioned, if you feel that earthquake along the coast, just go to high ground, don't take a chance. And then also for these distant events, just listen to your emergency managers at the local level to tell you, whether you should evacuate or not. Those are the two different types of scenarios that we could have, is one of the distant or local. And it's just about education, making sure that you understand what to do.
Right, right. Okay. Well, fascinating. Jackie, I'm sorry, did you have something else?
Well, I have a couple questions, but
sure.
No, you go ahead.
No, please.
Okay. All right. So I we saw on TV the Japan tsunami and the Indonesia tsunami. But let me get this right. It's not a wave. Is it more like a bathtub filling up? Is it more like the water just rises and it just keeps coming up? It's not going to be some monster crashing wave?
Well, it could start as a somewhat crashing wave. If you saw some of the video from Japan, it does travel at about 20 to 40 miles an hour once it gets on shore. So because it is that, it is, you're right, it is kind of like a bathtub where the water is filling in the voids. Water under gravity, if it's, like 10-foot wave, if it's under gravity and it has, a boundless amount of water behind it, it will just flood on shore, at 20 to 40 miles an hour. So gravity is the other culprit here, in causing that fast-moving tsunami.
Okay.
I think, of course, Japan is a special case for many reasons, but when you think of the preparation, the national will to be prepared for a tsunami, the 10-foot, in some cases, 14-foot seawalls that were inundated, it's just mind-boggling. There's no way that we even can imagine. They were prepared in every way, shape, or form, and it still was not enough. And that's kind of the lesson that no matter what we do, Mother Nature has a few more tricks in store for us when that time has come for that event to occur. So it was an amazing event.
Just one other thing, because we were, it's been mentioned two or three times now that as the wave comes ashore, as the surge comes ashore, it comes ashore at 20 to 40 miles an hour. But out in the middle of the ocean, I was woke up, Chief Kiela, when he started his talk about after the Japanese tsunami. He was woke up in the middle of the night, because that's his job. Mm-hmm. Shortly after, he was woke up and got into the city to start putting together a modified emergency operations center. He called me in the middle of the night and said, there's a possibility we may have a tsunami come, and there's a good possibility that we would activate CERT to go door to door. And so this was it. But in the middle of the ocean, we're talking this surge moving at 400 or 500 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's a very small surge out of the ocean. It's it could be a foot or 2 feet high, traveling at 500 miles an hour. And when it shallows, when it starts to get near a shoreline and it starts to shallow, that transfer from the speed of the tsunami to the height of the tsunami takes place. And so you have it slowing down, but you have the same amount of water. So where's that water going to go? It's going to rise. So that's why you have the, this difference in the speeds from the deep water to the shallow water and the difference in the wave heights.
And then also along those, it was discussed about boaters, fishermen being able to take their boats out. So if you could get your boat far enough away from shore, you would not have a big surge. But you need to be able to take your boat offshore and stay offshore for up to 24 hours. And many fishermen and boaters are not in position to do that.
Well, it was an incredible event, and we have some incredible public servants here helping us understand and be prepared. Rick Wilson, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And George, thank you.
Thank you. We try.
Yeah. Jackie, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, guys.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you soon. We have another show on Thursday. We hope you'll join us then. All right, bye-bye now.